Thank you very much. A lot of my friends say, how can you be optimistic when you talk about so many problems? A young man like that makes me optimistic. That is great. This is wonderful. John mentioned my wife, but I want my wife, Carol, to stand. Where is she hiding? Oh, right here. And also, a granddaughter is with us, Linda. But I want to thank you for the invitation to be here. It's a delight. Was anybody at the rally yesterday? Yeah. What do I have left to say? Unfortunately for you, yesterday I talked too long. So I'll have to think up something original. But it turns out that I do speak to a lot of different crowds, but I always talk about the same thing. It's always about liberty. And this is a great audience, and it's a great place to come to. I do want to acknowledge how successful the party's been up here, especially as a transition from a very tough campaign 4 years ago to the point of having three key individuals that I found fascinating during the 08 campaign. I think they told me one time they had not met each other, but now they're very good friends and very instrumental. And of course, AJ, your chairman, along with David and Drew. I think it's just fantastic what they've done and what all of you've done and given so many other people encouragement. Your outreach to the Maine delegates, I think this is just great. And it's a little bit more than party operations, which are so important, sometimes I'm not very good at, but these operations, though, when you're moving a cause, it makes it a little bit more worthwhile. And that's why I am so delighted to be here. Now, one thing I found fascinating about Drew when I got to know him, he is pretty old. He's probably a lot older than I am. But I think we were in the military about the same time, so we had a little bit, but I think he had a little tougher time than I did because, you know, I was a flight surgeon. And just a little brief personal note is when I was in college thinking about medical school, war was already an issue for me. And because I remember World War II and the Korean War and, of course, the Vietnam War came along. But the one thing I was convinced of was that I was not capable of picking up a rifle and shooting another person unless somebody was invading my house. Then I would be capable of defending my family. But it was something that it was not in my nature. And that is the reason, you know, one of the reasons I thought in medicine, you know, if I ever get drafted, I can be a doctor and it would be a different responsibility. So my responsibilities were a little bit different than Drew's because I was stationed in Texas and I traveled and I was in for 5 years. And fortunately, I didn't have to go through what so many others are going through right now, which really breaks my heart when I think about it because I'm not enthusiastic at all about fighting wars that make no sense. And therefore, I was directed in that way. But anyway, it is a real delight to be here. It's a delight to be with your senator from Iowa because Chuck and I served in the House of Representatives just a few years ago. He probably doesn't remember how long ago when he was in the House of Representatives. That's good to see you today. But it is very nice to be here. But, you know, Drew brought up a subject that I have to change my speech a little bit because he described his conversation with his 4-year-old grandson. And I thought, wow, that's pretty neat because I've always used the example. I said, I am convinced that I can talk to any 12-year-old and convince them that printing money and running up debt doesn't make any sense. But I didn't know you could talk a 4-year into that. You know, that doesn't say a whole lot for Washington, D.C., does it? But, you know, it isn't an accident. It isn't lack of common sense, because it is an intellectual bank, a brainwashing that happens. And ideas do have consequences. And we have been living with bad ideas. It's Keynesianism that I mentioned and talked about yesterday, as well as I talk about. We've lived with this. But Keynesianism teaches, you know, that your deficits don't matter. Deficits are good. You get into trouble, you get more deficit. And that's been pumped into us, you know, for 75 years. And, of course, the optimistic side of this, it's coming to an end, because it's every bit as bankrupt as communism is bankrupt. But they literally believe that if you spend too much money and you get into a problem, and for some vague reason about capitalism, people decide not to spend money, they have to spend money. If they won't spend money, if we tell them to spend money and borrow more money and get more credit cards, if they won't do it, it's the responsibility of the government to do it. So therefore, the government keeps spending money. And on the short run, just like you or I might be able to keep things going for a while, you know, we come up short and we get a new credit card, or we go to another bank and we keep borrowing. Oh, yeah, your standard of living goes up. That is, if you don't count your debt. But if there's a debt lined up against your new automobile and your new truck and your extra car and all these things, you're not really wealthier. But this country has assumed it has been wealthier all the time, because it borrows money and runs up debt, and they don't really balance the books. And Keynesians believe that there is that this is different for government than individuals. I don't believe that. I believe if you or I live way beyond our means and think that we can keep borrowing and get ourselves out of our personal recession, we're fooling ourselves, and eventually we're caught up, and we have to admit that we have to do what? We have to. The banks won't loan us any more money. If we're responsible, we want to pay off our debt. What we have to do is work harder, get another job, spend less, sell some stuff. And then when you get back down and make the correction, then you can have economic growth again. But if you as an individual or a country says what you need is more debt, it just delays the inevitable and makes the bubble worse and makes the correction worse. Because everybody said, you know, so often, and I was challenged during the campaign so often, what do you mean? You mean you would do nothing and there would have to be a correction? Yeah, that's what corrections are for, to correct the mistakes. Yeah, but how would it be tolerated? Not well, because people have been conditioned politically. I mean, how are you going to go to Washington and vote against the spending? Well, I never had any trouble with that. But I started doing that a long time before people started recognizing that the debt was exploding. And that is the problem, that if you cut back, if you as an individual cuts back, you know that you're going to have a lower standard of living. But the neat part about making a correction and not bailing out, people say, well, that's a tremendous sacrifice. I'd like to think of it as not so much of a sacrifice. My guess is there aren't too many in this room actually benefited from the bailouts. Anybody want to stand up and say, hey, I like bailouts and I really benefit? No, you didn't benefit. You're more likely to have suffered or know somebody that did, that lost a job and lost their house and suffered the consequences. And who got bailed out? The people who were making a lot of money. So the fact that there has to be a correction means that in many ways you don't have to sacrifice. You say, well, the government's not going to spend. They're not going to send you any money. Well, what if you got to keep your own money? My suggestion was, at the time the recession was approaching and when it finally hit, I suggested that why don't we suspend the income tax for about 5 or 10 years and then make it permanent? and then remove all the onerous regulations, those produced by both Republicans and Democrats, you know, all the regulations. Give us sound money. Go back to the market where if you're a saver, you get 5% instead of 0.5%. Let the market determine. Why should we have interest rates at zero and give the money for free to the banks and let them loan it back to the government so that they can borrow even more money? Now, that to me doesn't seem like a sacrifice. Give you back your liberty, allow to keep what you earn, build up the incentive, let the market work. But the big problem is there would be somebody who would really suffer. And that would be the big banks and the big corporations. That's who would suffer. Over the last 5 years, as you probably had noticed on occasion during a debate, I would have to suffer the humiliation of the ridicule about the foreign policy. And, of course, who was it that advised us to stay out of this mess? Guys like Robert Taft, Mr. Republican, we have a statute in Washington, D.C. for. People like Eisenhower said, watch out for the military-industrial complex. There's an announcement today that our balance, you know, everybody worries about the balance of trade. We ruin our economy here. We have this super strong reserve currency of the world that chases all our jobs overseas. And we, it's all China's fault and they're cheating and all this stuff. We won't look to ourselves for our problems. So we're always in a mess with balance of trade. But guess what? There are very encouraging statistics on trade today. Guess what? We produce and spend and sell overseas 70% of all the manufacturing of weaponry.
Wow.
Guess what? Who makes money on that? You know, there is an industry out there that makes money off that. $66 billion we sold overseas. And of course, it's wonderful because we're sending it to countries that are going to be great Democrats, and we're going to change their whole style of living. Now, of course, they've lived that way for thousands of years, and we're going to send over and march in and impose our ways on them. So yes, that cannot be the answer. This imposition of our views on other people, and just saying that we will sell these weapons. We now are selling weapons, major aircraft. Of course, it's good for the aircraft industry. To Iraq. We're going to arm them because Iraq is our friend. We've established their government. Iraq now is a much closer ally to Iran. And Iran, of course, we're going to destroy Iran by sanctions. Put on sanctions. That'll destroy the people, of course, and enhance their government. It never really helps the people. So who helps the Iranians right now to get around the sanctions? Iraq government, our government that we've imposed. And guess what? We're sending them weapons. So in a way, we're actually arming a government who's becoming closer and closer to the Iranian government. And the odds of, if we sell them 100 airplanes now, which is, look, I don't know what the number is, but they're going to buy these airplanes, good for business here. But the odds are probably fairly great that those weapons could very well be used against us someday. So I would say we ought to be out of the business of selling weapons around the world and spend that money here at home. So obviously, if we want to see some changes in this country, we do have to change, you know, our attitude about the role of government. That really is what it boils down to. Ideas, of course, have consequences. Ideas determine what the role of government is and what the prevailing attitude is. Attitudes are pretty important. When the people in this country rise up and say Congress overstepped their bounds and there's unity on that, Congress will act. And they will respond. But the big problem is, for the most part, they don't know about all the details. It's, if the media really reported on what was happening in foreign policy, people would even be more outraged. So it's taken a long time. It's taken 10 years for the American people to move from not wanting to go to war the war propaganda came, everybody supports the war, or you were unpatriotic and against the troops and all that business. And then support for the war, and it goes on, and then the people get tired. And since you don't, the people don't hear about it, it's only gradual. To the point now where 70% of the American people say, enough is enough. You know, we can't continue to do this. It's not helping us. Our country is poor. And if you come around to this extreme idea that spending is the problem, you know, that maybe this could be an easy place. Instead of this being a sacred cow that you can't cut one nickel out of the military budget, why wouldn't it be easier to address that than food stamps or health care for the poor? You know, it's not good politics. I happen not to support and wouldn't have voted for the welfare programs, but I think just common sense on working back would be that we go after this overseas stuff and say, look, this is a way we can tide ourselves over and make sure that the people don't lose their health care and work our way out of it. But if we are unable to cut military and domestic and get back to it, believe me, every one of us are going to suffer because there will be a dollar crisis. And the other thing that I think we have to address, all of us who serve in Congress and are interested, what we have to really talk about is this big fiction about the budget. Do you understand what the term baseline budgeting means? That is sinful. That is so much deceit. What they do is they come along and say, government, it's based on the assumption that government has to automatically grow a certain percentage every year. Oh, well, there's inflation, okay? We got to go up for inflation. Oh, there's population growth. Oh, you know, there'll be greater needs and we have to be prepared for recession. So we have baseline budgeting. You know, it used to be, as a kid, I remember the communists were, you know, planners. They had 5-year plans. We have 30-year plans now. We set the budget and this is the way it's supposed to grow. All right, so I'll take these numbers, I'll just throw out. Okay, $500 billion for military. Okay, it's gonna be 600 out here. And okay, if you cut it down to 550 instead of the proposed increase up to 600, oh, there's outrages. You're gonna destroy the jobs. And then conservatives become military Keynesians. It's hard bad for jobs. Well, you know, on the short run, yes, we might have less job building weapons and selling them to our enemies. But you always have to ask the questions which was asked by Bastiat. Instead of what? Where does the money go? Does it mean if you don't spend $100 billion on militarism, does that mean you just remove it from the economy? No, that $100 billion stays in the economy, stays in your pocket. You get to spend it, educate your kids. Instead, if you spend $100 billion building drone missiles and bombs and declaring that we own the world and we can drop a missile on any place, anytime we want, what that does, it's a negative economic problem, building more animosity toward us. At the same time, it didn't solve a bit of a problem and contributed to our debt. So a little bit of common sense would go a long way. We need the common sense of a 4-year-old. That's what we need. So what are the odds of this coming together? Well, you know, when you describe what's happening, and if you describe, you know, the day-to-day events in Washington, we can get pretty despondent over this and say, hey, there's no way this is going to happen. But no, it's not necessary. I mean, ideas are important, and that is where we're winning. People say, well, how do you put up with this? You've been talking about this for 30 years, and what do you have to show for it? How many bills have you passed? Well, not too many. But thank goodness, if my success had been measured on passing bills and getting people to support me, I would have had to go their way to get their votes. So now, the immediate victories aren't there, but we, you know, even in the primary, we talk about Maine and the delegation there, and even the races here in Iowa, you know, there were times when, in Maine especially, I really believed that we were doing very, very well there, even on the popular vote. So, but the victories aren't there. You say complete defeat, you know, no. But no, I think we keep winning. The harder they try to silence us, the harder they try to push us around, the harder the time they try to take our delegates away. I think it's an incentive. It is a tremendous incentive for everybody to work harder. And since they're, like yesterday I described, that era is over. It's over and done with. Keynesianism is a dead issue anymore. It won't work. The only thing that counts is the spirit of liberty. And the spirit of liberty is alive and well, and that's what this campaign has been all about. And that is why I am just so energized when I go to the campuses, the conservative campuses. And the freedom issue goes everywhere. It is bringing people together. It is, they think this, you know, working with people who disagree, liberals and all, you have to compromise and give up on your beliefs. No, the freedom message brings people together, because even though we could go to Texas A&M, rather conservative campus, and get a large crowd, we can go to Berkeley, you know, that communist haven of the 1960s, where they still have communist professors, and get 8,500 people come out, much bigger than the conservative campuses. So as long as that spirit of liberty and love of liberty, which did inspire many great things in this country, as long as that's alive, and as long as we meet and see so many young people like John getting energized and participating, you know, I think the progress is great. So the victories, the day-to-day victories, you know, the victory of yesterday or lack of victory this week and the election, it's almost irrelevant compared to what really happens on the day-to-day victories, because it's the war. It's the intellectual war that we have to win. And one example that I use that I think is a perfect example for what I'm talking about, and that has to do with a conversation following the Vietnam War, the conversation with Colonel Two and Colonel Harry Summers. Two lieutenant colonels or four colonels, they got together 1974 to talk about prison repatriation and settle it, get this war over with. And they got together, and of course Summers just couldn't give up on the idea that we weren't a military power any longer. We're losing, we're walking out, and we don't want to admit it. So his last effort was to show that we were still strong. And he says to Two, he says, "Colonel," he says, "you have to admit yet you never beat us once on the battlefield." And Two looked and he said, he says, "Colonel," he says, "you're exactly right, but it's irrelevant." It's irrelevant because they won the war. And we can win the war on ideas. We can win the wars. So the day-to-day victories, as great as they are, and when we can get AJ to be the chairman of the state party, that is a victory, and it's a reflection. So all the victories are important, but they aren't the end game. The end game is who wins the war. And if you see it as an intellectual war, I'll tell you what, we're way ahead of those who are operating on a bankrupt idea, and ours are the views that has made this country great, and there's no reason in the world why we can't remain optimistic. Thank you very much.